A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those prompts where the personal observation is doing more scientific heavy lifting than he probably realizes. He's got a lifelong discomfort around dogs, not a full-blown clinical phobia, but enough that it gets in the way. And he's noticed something specific. If he's had a few drinks and encounters a dog, the fear evaporates. It doesn't just get quieter. It's gone. And he's asking what's actually happening in the brain when that happens, whether it's more than just Dutch courage, and whether understanding the mechanism points toward a real therapeutic path that doesn't require alcohol.
This is a genuinely good question, because the standard explanation people reach for, alcohol just lowers your inhibitions, end of story, that's not wrong, but it's incomplete in a way that matters. And Daniel's own framing hints at why. He said it feels like his true inner self isn't afraid of dogs, and the alcohol is revealing that rather than creating it. That's not just a nice metaphor. There's neuroscience that maps onto exactly that intuition.
Let's unpack what's actually happening when that beer hits your system, and the German Shepherd suddenly seems less terrifying. Because I think the folk wisdom around Dutch courage has been sitting there for centuries, and most people never ask the follow-up question, courage to do what, specifically? And why does it seem to target fear rather than just making you generally sloppy?
And the distinction matters because if alcohol were just a general emotional dampener, if it turned down the volume on everything equally, then you'd expect Daniel to also stop finding the beach pleasant, or stop enjoying the conversation he's having. But that's not what happens. He's still present, still enjoying himself. The fear specifically gets deleted from the experience. That selectivity is the clue that something more interesting is going on.
To understand why alcohol has this specific effect, we need to look at three things. GABA, the amygdala, and something called memory reconsolidation. And I'm going to let you take the lead on the first two, because this is squarely in your territory.
Let's start with GABA. GABA is gamma-aminobutyric acid. It's the brain's primary inhibitory neurotransmitter. If the brain were a car, GABA would be the brake pedal. Its job is to slow things down, reduce neural firing, keep the system from overheating. Alcohol happens to be a powerful GABA, a receptor potentiator. When you drink, alcohol binds to specific sites on GABA, a receptors, and makes them more responsive to GABA. The result is enhanced inhibition across the brain. Now here's where it gets specific. The amygdala, which is the brain's fear hub, the structure that flags threats and generates the physiological fear response, is densely packed with GABA. A receptors. So when alcohol hits your system, it disproportionately dampens amygdala activity. The fear circuitry gets the brakes applied harder than other systems.
Which explains why the fear drops out while other functions stay online. It's not that alcohol is surgically precise. It's that the amygdala is especially sensitive to GABA potentiation because it's got so many of those receptors. The brake pedal just works better there.
But that's only half the story, and it's the less interesting half. What you just described is acute suppression. The alcohol is in your system, it's dampening the amygdala, you feel less fear. The alcohol wears off, the suppression lifts, the fear comes back. That's the temporary effect. But there's evidence that alcohol is doing something else simultaneously, something that can outlast the drug itself.
This is where memory reconsolidation comes in, and this is the part that I think most people miss when they chalk the whole thing up to Dutch courage.
Here's the key insight from the last couple decades of memory research. We used to think memories worked like files on a hard drive. You save them, they sit there unchanged, and when you recall them, you're just opening a read-only file. That turns out to be completely wrong. Every time you retrieve a memory, it becomes temporarily labile, unstable, malleable, for a window of about 6 hours. During that window, the memory can be strengthened, weakened, or modified before it gets restored. That process is called reconsolidation, and it's not just a quirk of the system. It's the mechanism by which memories get updated with new information.
When Daniel encounters a dog while he's had a couple of drinks, two things are happening at once. The alcohol is acutely suppressing his amygdala response, so he's not feeling the fear in the moment. But he's also retrieving the fear memory. The German Shepherd is triggering the old association. And because alcohol is in his system during that retrieval, the memory gets restored in a weakened state. The emotional charge gets dialed down.
There's a 2019 study from the University of Illinois that demonstrated exactly this. Researchers gave rats ethanol before fear extinction training. That's where you expose the animal to the feared stimulus without the bad outcome over and over until the fear response diminishes. The rats that got ethanol showed significantly reduced fear responses when tested days later, completely sober. The alcohol wasn't in their system anymore. The effect persisted. And critically, the rats that did the extinction training without ethanol showed less durable fear reduction. The alcohol had helped override the original fear memory, not just mask it temporarily.
That's the difference between suppression and reconsolidation. Suppression is borrowing a friend's calm demeanor for the evening. Reconsolidation is actually editing the file. And the rat study suggests alcohol can facilitate the editing process, not just the borrowing.
Now let me add another layer, because this gets even more interesting when you bring in the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is the brain's executive control center. It's involved in planning, decision-making, and also in regulating the amygdala. Normally, when you encounter something you're afraid of, there's a conversation between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. The amygdala screams threat, and the prefrontal cortex is supposed to evaluate whether the threat is real and then either amplify or dampen the amygdala's response. In phobias, that conversation is broken. The prefrontal cortex is actually overengaged in the wrong direction. It's hypervigilantly confirming the threat rather than disconfirming it.
You've got this loop where the amygdala fires. The prefrontal cortex goes, "Yep, that's definitely dangerous," which makes the amygdala fire harder, which makes the prefrontal cortex double down. It's a fear amplifier.
And alcohol depresses prefrontal cortex function. That's why you get impaired judgment, reduced impulse control, all the classic intoxication effects. But here's the counterintuitive part. In the context of a phobia, depressing the prefrontal cortex can actually be helpful. It quiets that overthinking, hypervigilant voice that's constantly telling the amygdala this is dangerous. And when that voice goes quiet, the amygdala is free to update its threat assessment based on what's actually happening in the moment. The dog is barking, but it's not attacking. The dog is wagging its tail. The dog's owner is laughing. The real-time evidence says safe, but the phobic brain's prefrontal cortex was shouting over that evidence. Alcohol turns down the shout.
You've got a triple mechanism. GABA potentiation directly dampens the amygdala. Memory reconsolidation allows the fear memory to be updated. And prefrontal depression silences the hypervigilant inner monologue that was preventing new learning from happening. All three of those things are happening simultaneously when Daniel has his beer at the beach bar and the German Shepherd lopes by.
This explains something Daniel mentioned that I think is really insightful. He said he spent a summer walking his uncle's dog in London, and it normalized being around a dog in that context, but it wasn't a total cure. That's a perfect example of what psychologists call context-specific learning. His brain learned that this specific dog, in this specific place, with this specific routine, is safe. But that learning didn't generalize to strange dogs on a Tel Aviv beach. The original fear memory is still sitting there, intact, ready to be triggered in novel contexts.
Which brings us to the concept of state-dependent learning. There's a phenomenon where information learned in a particular physiological state, intoxicated, caffeinated, whatever, is best retrieved in that same state. If Daniel only ever encounters dogs while drinking, the new non-fearful association might get encoded as an alcohol state memory. It won't transfer to sobriety. The fear reduction only works in the alcohol state. That's the trap. You're not curing the phobia. You're creating a parallel, context-dependent version of yourself that isn't afraid.
That's the limitation of the alcohol approach. It opens the reconsolidation window, but it also tags the new learning with the alcohol state. So what you really want is a way to open that reconsolidation window without creating state dependence. And that's where the therapeutic promise gets really interesting.
If alcohol can temporarily open this window for fear memory updating, the obvious question is, can we keep that window open without the alcohol? That's where the real therapeutic promise lies.
Let's talk about propranolol. Propranolol is a beta blocker. It's been around for decades, primarily used for high blood pressure and performance anxiety. It works by blocking noradrenaline receptors. Noradrenaline is a stress hormone that, among other things, plays a crucial role in tagging memories as emotionally significant. When you experience something scary, noradrenaline surges, and that surge essentially tells your brain this is important. Encode this strongly. That's why you can remember exactly where you were on September 11th, but not what you had for lunch that day.
Noradrenaline is the highlighter pen of the memory system.
That's a perfect way to put it. And propranolol takes away the highlighter. When you take propranolol before recalling a fear memory, the memory gets retrieved, enters that labile reconsolidation window, but the noradrenaline signaling that would normally re-tag it as emotionally significant is blocked. So the memory gets restored with less emotional charge, and unlike alcohol, propranolol doesn't create state dependence. The memory update persists into normal, drug-free states.
There was a study on this, right? Spider phobia? Propranolol? Exposure therapy?
Yes, a 2015 study with spider-phobic individuals. One group got propranolol before a brief exposure session. The other got a placebo. At a one-week follow-up, the propranolol group showed significantly reduced fear responses. And they weren't on propranolol at the follow-up. The effect had outlasted the drug. That's the reconsolidation blockade in action. You're not suppressing fear in the moment. You're editing the underlying memory so it stops generating fear at all.
This is fundamentally different from traditional exposure therapy. Exposure therapy works by creating a new, competing memory. You learn that the spider didn't bite you, and that new safety memory eventually becomes stronger than the old fear memory. But the fear memory is still there. It can resurface under stress, or in a new context. Reconsolidation-based approaches target the original memory directly. You're not building a competing file, you're editing the original file.
That distinction is enormous, and it's why the therapeutic implications are so exciting. Traditional exposure therapy for phobias can take 8 to 12 sessions, sometimes more. And relapse rates are significant because, as you said, the fear memory is still lurking underneath. A reconsolidation-based approach could theoretically work in a single session. You retrieve the fear memory, intervene during the 6-hour reconsolidation window, and the memory gets restored with less emotional weight.
Now, propranolol isn't FDA-approved specifically for phobia treatment yet. It's prescribed off-label by some clinicians, but the protocol is straightforward. You take it about 60 to 90 minutes before a therapy session. During the session, you briefly recall the fear memory, not prolonged exposure, just enough to trigger reconsolidation. And then the drug does its work over the following hours as the memory is restored. It's not a daily medication. It's not something you take forever. It's a targeted intervention, timed to the reconsolidation window.
Here's something I want to flag because it directly addresses Daniel's situation. The fact that he's observed the alcohol effect is diagnostically significant. It tells you that his fear memory is malleable. Not all fear memories are equally amenable to reconsolidation-based interventions. Some are so over-consolidated, so deeply encoded over decades of reinforcement that they resist updating. But Daniel's own experience is proof that his fear circuitry can be quieted. His brain is capable of non-fearful responses to dogs. That's useful information for any therapist he might work with.
It's like the alcohol is a diagnostic probe. It reveals that the fear isn't structural. It's not hardwired. The capacity for a different response is already in there. The question is just how to access it without the probe.
There's another approach I want to mention that doesn't involve any medication at all. There was a 2021 study that found 10 minutes of high-intensity interval training after recalling a fear. Memory reduced physiological fear responses 24 hours later. The proposed mechanism is fascinating. Exercise causes a noradrenaline surge, so it's doing the opposite of propranolol pharmacologically. But that surge, coming right after memory retrieval, creates what's called a prediction error signal. The brain expects one thing based on the old memory, gets a flood of arousal that doesn't match the expectation, and that mismatch drives new learning. It's a different route to the same destination, destabilizing the old memory and allowing an update.
You've got alcohol, which works through GABA and prefrontal depression, propranolol, which works through noradrenaline blockade, and exercise, which works through noradrenaline surge and prediction error. Three completely different mechanisms, all converging on the same reconsolidation window. The common thread is that you need to retrieve the fear memory and then do something that disrupts its restorage.
This brings me back to something Daniel said that I think is worth taking seriously. He said it feels like his true inner self isn't afraid of dogs. Now, is true inner self a neuroscientifically rigorous concept? But it maps onto something real. The inhibitory learning model of phobia holds that the fear isn't erased. Instead, a new, non-fearful association is learned that competes with the old one. Under normal circumstances, the fear association wins because it's older, stronger, and more rehearsed. Alcohol temporarily tips the balance. The non-fearful association gets to be the dominant one for a while.
The true inner self isn't some deep essence being revealed. It's a competing memory trace that's usually losing the fight. The alcohol isn't uncovering truth. It's changing the odds of which memory wins the retrieval competition. But the fact that the non-fearful trace exists at all is hopeful. It means the raw materials for a cure are already in Daniel's brain.
That's where a therapist would start. You don't need to build a new response from scratch. You need to strengthen the response that's already there and weaken the one that's causing problems. Reconsolidation-based interventions are essentially a way to tip the balance permanently, rather than temporarily like alcohol does.
Let's make this concrete. Here are three things, Daniel, and anyone with a similar phobia can actually do.
First, and this is the lowest barrier to entry, prediction error exposure. The idea is to deliberately put yourself in low-stakes situations with dogs and actively, consciously note when the expected bad outcome doesn't happen. The key word is actively. It's not enough to just be near a dog and survive. You have to mentally register the mismatch between expectation and reality. Your brain predicted barking equals danger equals I need to flee. But you're still here. The dog barked and nothing happened. You need to narrate that to yourself, almost like you're a scientist taking field notes. The surprise signal is what drives new learning.
The reason most casual exposure doesn't work is that people white-knuckle through it. They're physically present but mentally checked out, just waiting for it to be over. That doesn't create a prediction error. It just reinforces the feeling of danger with extra steps.
You have to engage with the mismatch. Second actionable step, talk to a therapist about propranolol. It's a well-studied, generally safe medication. It's been around since the 1960s. The side effect profile is mild for most people. Some fatigue, some cold hands. It's not a controlled substance, it's not addictive, and the protocol for phobia treatment typically involves taking it only before specific therapy sessions, not daily. Some clinicians are already doing this off-label. It's worth a conversation.
Third, recognize that the alcohol observation itself is clinically useful. If Daniel walks into a therapist's office and says, "I've noticed that two beers makes my dog fear disappear," a good therapist will perk up at that. It's a diagnostic clue that his fear memory is in the sweet spot for reconsolidation-based approaches. Not too entrenched, not too mild. That's actionable information.
I'd also add that the exercise protocol is worth experimenting with, though the research is newer and the protocols aren't as well established. The basic idea is, briefly recall the fear memory. Maybe 30 seconds of deliberately thinking about the German Shepherd encounter, and then immediately do something that gets your heart rate up significantly for 10 minutes. Sprints, burpees, whatever. The timing matters. You want the noradrenaline surge to hit while the memory is still in that labile reconsolidation window.
None of these are magic bullets, but they're all grounded in the same neuroscience that explains why Daniel's beer at the beach bar works in the first place. The common thread is that fear memories are not permanent inscriptions. They're dynamic processes that get rewritten every time they're accessed, and that rewriting process is something you can influence.
There's a broader point here that's worth making. Everything we've been talking about, reconsolidation, GABA, noradrenaline, it applies far beyond dog phobias. This is how memory works, period. Every time you recall anything, you're not playing back a recording. You're reconstructing the memory from scratch, and the reconstruction is influenced by your current state, your current context, your current beliefs. That's why eyewitness testimony is so unreliable. That's why couples argue about what really happened 5 years ago. Memory is not a filing cabinet. It's a story we keep rewriting.
That's both unsettling and hopeful. It's unsettling because it means our sense of a stable past is partly an illusion. but it's hopeful because it means memories that are causing suffering. Phobias, trauma, painful associations. Those aren't permanent either. They can be rewritten. Not erased, exactly, but edited into something less harmful.
Where does this leave us? The beer isn't the solution, but it might be the map. Daniel's observation at that Tel Aviv beach bar is a window into the plasticity of fear. The goal isn't to drink away the phobia. It's to learn from what the drink reveals that the fear circuitry can be quieted, that the non-fearful response is already in there, and that the reconsolidation window is a real opportunity for lasting change.
The open question is how quickly reconsolidation-based therapies will become mainstream. Propranolol for phobia treatment is still off-label. The exercise protocol needs more replication. But the trajectory is clear. We're moving from a model where phobias are treated through months of gradual exposure to one where a single well-timed intervention, a pill, a workout, maybe eventually a precisely targeted brain stimulation, could permanently reduce or eliminate a fear that's been there for decades. The ethical questions around pharmacologically editing memories are real and worth wrestling with. But for someone like Daniel, who's been dealing with this since childhood and has already tried the behavioral route, the risk-benefit calculus seems pretty straightforward.
If anyone listening has had a similar experience, alcohol or any other substance temporarily dissolving a fear, or if you've tried propranolol or exercise-based approaches for a phobia, email the show. We're at show@myweirdprompts.com. Daniel's observation sparked this whole episode, and I suspect there are a lot of people out there with similar data points who've never connected them to the underlying neuroscience.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The sport of real tennis, the indoor precursor to modern lawn tennis, uses a scoring system where the server calls out, "Chase better than a chasse," a phrase that entered Middle English from Old French chase, meaning the fall of the ball on the court. The word chase in modern English ultimately descends from the same Latin root captare as the word catch, which is why, in the early medieval period, a hunted animal was both chased and caught with the same linguistic breath.
Chasing and catching were literally the same word.
That explains a lot about my archery practice. Hilbert, thank you.
This has been my Weird Prompts. If you got something out of this episode, the single best thing you can do is leave a review wherever you're listening. It helps other people find the show. We're at myweirdprompts.com, and you can email us your own prompts at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.